But first, it's day three of the government shutdown. There was an Obama, Biden, Boehner, Pelosi, Reid, McConnell meeting at the White House late Wednesday that yielded nothing that we know of in terms of solving the impasse. Meantime, Americans continue to express their anger and their outrage at all sides involved in this stalemate. We wanted to get some historical perspective and context to all of this. Has America weathered standoffs like this in the past? What can history teach us about the divisions that we see now among the president, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, especially the far-right Republicans? Is finding common ground even possible in Washington in 2013? For that, we turn to our favorite political historian. He directs the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. Gleaves Whitney, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I have to ask you, Gleaves, I've got to imagine many Americans are wondering, is this what the Founding Fathers had in mind?
No, it's not. I think the Founding Fathers were eminent realists. They understood that there would be different factions, different parties, but they also understood they had to work together. And the example I always go back to is the convention that created our Constitution. There were people at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 who had wildly different views of even what a human being was. They couldn't decide whether blacks were even humans worthy of citizenship or not. And that's why you had South Carolina delegates, for example, threatening to walk out of the convention. On the other hand, you had Northern abolitionists who said, no, they are equal. But somehow they were able to put aside their differences. They agreed that sometimes it's necessary to work through those problems so that you could form a more perfect union. And, you know, every generation since has been challenged to form a more perfect union. How do we make this country better? And this generation in Congress needs to do the same.
So what do you think has happened to put these opposing sides of this issue so far apart and so unwilling to bend and to do the horse trading and the bargaining that leads to the compromise?
Well, you know, we've created a new verb in our language. It's called primarying. We primary people out of existence if we don't like them, man, if they're not pure enough. And, you know, you can purify yourself. You could even purify your party out of existence if you're not careful. Politics is the art of the possible. It requires compromise. It requires people coming together who say, look, I differ from you, but we can find a way to come to some agreement on some principles. But with the primary system the way it is now, and, you know, the extreme right on the Republican side and the extreme left on the liberal side, the Democratic side, you have people now who are unwilling to talk to each other, and they threaten the existing office holder. We've seen this in congressional district after congressional district. And it has been aggravated by gerrymandering, where we now can micro-target constituents with the powerful analytical tools that we have on the computers that can form these districts that get a district to look very much alike so that people don't have to talk to folks with whom they disagree. This is so different from what was happening after World War II. You know, you had a consensus generation fight in World War II. It didn't matter if you were Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, atheist. When you were in a foxhole with these other folks, you found a way to bond with them, and you had common ground literally right there in the trenches. That generation came home after World War II. They served in Washington as representatives. They took their families to Washington. They had their families, their wives over for dinner. Their kids went to the same schools. People went to the PTA meetings, and all of them were in it together, whether there were R's or D's behind their name. Wow. We've lost that. I mean, today, families don't go to Washington, D.C. They stay back in their home district. The reps are, you know, looking at a pretty safe gerrymandered district in which they can be primaried if they out of existence if they aren't towing a party line.
Gleaves Whitney, as you look at what's being said by all parties, from the president to the leadership of both parties in the House and in the Senate, is there blame to go around equally as far as people saying, I'm not budging. You figure it out, but I'm not budging. And we hear that from everybody, and then you go, well, where's the movement? Is there blame to go around?
I think there's blame to go around, but part of it also are the structural problems, you know, the gerrymandering, the fact that families do not accompany the reps to Washington anymore. Plus you have, you know, the news channels, the cable TV channels that pander to certain points of view, whether it's, you know, Fox for the Republicans or MSNBC for the Democrats. you know, people are just all hot and bothered about that next soundbite, you know, without really thinking about what it requires to sit down and talk. So, yeah, there's a lot of blame to go around. And, you know, Edmund Burke gave us a very, very important principle back in the 18th century, and certainly James Madison picked up on the same when he was thinking about the founding of this country and what kind of constitution would work. Both Burke and Madison agreed that representatives have to use sometimes independent judgment. They cannot just be a mirror of the most extreme constituents or the loudest voices back home. They have to be able to go to Washington with a willingness to serve the common good. How do you find those compromises that will actually work and preserve a level of civility in the process so people can come back another day? It's doable. We need some history lessons to help these guys do it now.
Well, your piece on the Hauenstein Center website called Is Common Ground Possible makes a point that I want to talk more about. And here is your quote. America has ideologues, but we are not an ideological nation. We are neither overwhelmingly conservative nor predominantly progressive. Where U.S. history actually happens is in the conversation, conflicts, and compromises between the two camps. So is that telling us, Gleaves, we should not fear this conflict?
There will always be conflict. And I'm so glad you read that quotation out of the article, because that does summarize exactly where we are, where we've been in this country since our beginning. You know, you do have any free society is going to have a party of innovation and a party of conservation, and they're going to have to figure out a way to work together. So what I'm trying to do here at the Hauenstein Center is bring liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans together, and speak through their challenges in civil discourse. We have a lot of good historic examples. And people, I think, can make progress. There's some great techniques. I mean, there's the Harvard Negotiation Project. There's the Delphi Method. We know there are techniques that work, but we've got to separate these representatives from the loudest voices back home in their constituency so that they're not afraid of being primaried.
Give us another history lesson. You talked about the Constitutional Convention and what happened then. Can you give us another good lesson that history could teach us about what needs to happen to move us forward?
Well, let me say certainly that when we don't find common ground, this is when you have Preston Smith caning Charles Sumner on the Senate floor in 1856. I mean, it comes to fisticuffs. And, you know, you've had a lot of examples.
You have a civil war.
Yeah, and then a civil war 4 or 5 years later.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, another good example, I mean, look at how I love the example of right here in Michigan politics. You know, go back 20 years, go back to Michigan in 1992 when we saw that our House would be divided equally 55-55 between Republicans and Democrats. Curtis Hertel and Paul Hillegons, Democrat and Republican, had to deal with that split in the House. And I've talked to both of those gentlemen about that era, and what they did was they decided we're going to go out to dinner, we're going to play cards together, we're going to get our families together, we're going to try to establish a personal relationship so we don't look at each other as enemies, but sometimes as opponents on issues. So right here in Michigan, we have a great example of what can happen when you have that comity. And they ended up being a very, very powerful duo. We went through some dramatic changes in 93 and 94 with bipartisan bills being passed. So that's a great example on the state level. There are lots of examples on the federal level as well.
What do you believe, Gleaves, that historians will say about this episode in America's history, let's say 50 years out?
That's a great question. I'm not real optimistic about the short term, but I do think that I would say this to people in the Tea Party right now. Even if you believe, or people who are following the Tea Party, believe that the goal is good. Yeah, of course we want to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. The political tactic being used right now will surely benefit President Obama. And I think that that's going to be a large lesson that Republicans are going to have to learn. I think they're going to really get it on the chin in the next election because of what's happening today.
Gleaves Whitney directs the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. It's always great to talk with you, and I'm sure we'll be doing it again soon.
I always look forward to it.
You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio.
The sun is our greatest source of natural energy.
Someday we may use sunlight to power everything.
The technology is here. We could build solar panels, hot water heaters, even solar cars. The more we shift to solar power, the healthier our planet will be.
the power is yours!
Cars that run on solar power aren't in every driveway like Captain Planet hoped in that clip from back 20 years ago. But a group of students from the University of Michigan are helping keep the dream of solar-powered cars alive. The U of M solar car team is currently down under, getting ready for 5 days of racing across the Australian outback. It's the World Solar Challenge, and it starts Sunday. They'll be competing against teams from around the globe, shooting for the fastest time on an 1,800-mile course from the top of the continent to the bottom. And they'll get there using nothing but the sun in a jet-like roadster designed and built entirely by students. No slouches in the world of solar racing. The U of M team is the best in the country with 7 North American championships under their belt. They finished 3rd in the World Challenge 5 times, and they're hoping that this year they can catch enough rays to make it to number 1. Still to come, musician Zach Saganaw has been making electronic music for years. He has a new album out, and we're going to find out why he still finds inspiration in his home state of Michigan. That conversation in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What if you could build a preschool from the ground up? What if you could take the things that seem to work well, take out what doesn't, and build in new ideas after you listen to your community? Well, that's exactly what my next guest is doing. Ryan Brown hopes to reimagine what early childhood education looks like and feels like. He's doing it with the U School opening next June in Ann Arbor. And what's happening in these months before the U School opens is worth looking at and learning from. Ryan Brown is the co-founder, executive director, and he will be a classroom teacher at the U School when it opens. He joins us now. Welcome and good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what the U in U School, this is not Y-O-U, this is the letter U. What does it stand for?
The U in the U School is our most guiding principle. It stands for a word called Ubuntu, which is from Southern Africa. I'm originally from South Africa. I was born in South Africa in Cape Town. And it literally means I am because you are. Okay? And so this is a philosophy of humanism that runs deep within the culture of South Africa. It's a philosophy that helped South Africa come out of apartheid during that incredible transition. And what it really speaks to is the idea of the individual and the group. So while an individual should be able to follow their dreams, pursue their passions, have goals in life, and really commit to those, Ubuntu says that's very important, but we also need to take care of the collective group. We need to make sure that our team, our community, is also enhancing in the same manner in terms of pursuing dreams and goals with community values.
And as you do all the groundwork for opening the school next summer, what does that mean? You're building it from the ground up. What's different about what you want the U School to be?
You know, it's a really big question, right? Early childhood development is really human resource capital. And so with that in mind, it's incredibly complex. There's many, many layers. The layer that we're really focusing right now is embedding the fabric of our community into the school from the ground up. So one of the challenges in education, no matter what level you're on, is engaging community, because community is so important to the individual and to our team. And so our golden opportunity right now is reaching out to the community, finding out where our strengths are, where are areas for improvement with young children and families in mind, showcasing those strengths and working on those areas to be improved, and doing that from the beginning and starting there.
And doing it with the guidance of educators?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I am a graduate from the University of Michigan Dearborn, from their graduate program, Early Childhood Administration and Leadership. We have on our advisory board some people that have been working in education for a number of years. And our team all has a background in education. But really the idea is that everybody's an expert in community experience. Hmm. You know, everybody lives their life in the community and understands things they'd like to see differently and what is working well. And so when we think of our team, it's a very holistic team encompassing many different community circles or sectors.
Well, let's talk about a school that you want to see the doors opening next summer. So you do this, you've talked to the community, you've got this philosophy of I am because you are underpinning everything. So what will be different and you hope better when those doors open from what's available now for early childhood education?
You know, what we want to do differently is start with community partners and invested individuals and organizations that are outside of the early childhood background and work together in terms of thinking what kind of resources can we do to support our families, whether it's a business owner inside their own business or what can they do to help support a school in town? What kind of resources can they offer? Doing better for young children and families in an inclusive manner. And so when I mean inclusive in terms of socioeconomic status and also inclusive in terms of children abilities.
And you're looking at children from ages 0 to 6?
We have programming for children ages 0 to 6. Our classroom program is called U Learning, and that is for children ages 3 to 6. And then we also have programming called U Family, and that is designed for families with children birth to 3. And so that program encompasses parent workshops, parent classes, parent-child play groups.
You can see bringing this to other corners of Michigan?
I think so. And I think that what we can do is help other communities think about the early childhood experience in their community. So one thing in education, people are desperately searching for solutions right now. It's mm-hmm. a fascinating transition that we are in the midst of with funding education and what learning should look like for the 21st century. But it's this idea of taking something off the shelf and that will work somewhere else is not quite how we see things. We really think that education should be one based on the individual child, but bigger than that, also the individual community and looking at what's happening in that community and how to best serve that community.
The website is theubuntuschool.com, and Ryan Brown, the co-founder, executive director, and a future classroom teacher at the U School, which calls itself a new model early childhood and family learning center, opening next June in Ann Arbor, and the meetings with the community going on as you lay the groundwork for the U School. Ryan, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
From new ideas now to old and continuing ideas for children and their families, 100 years old to be precise. The Star Commonwealth Organization, based in Albion, is celebrating a century this year, a century of helping Michigan's vulnerable, kids with difficult childhoods, children in foster care with emotional and psychological problems, or issues of substance abuse. Dr. Martin Mitchell is president and CEO of Star Commonwealth, and he joins us now, and I'd like to focus on this quote from the founder of Star Commonwealth, Floyd Starr, who said, "There is no such thing as a bad child." How has that statement been a basis for the work you do?
Well, thank you, Cindy. Star Commonwealth, since 1913, has really built its whole reputation off of that statement. We really believe that children, if given the opportunity and given a great environment, can go on to do great things in their lives. And that's what Star Commonwealth has done for now 100 years, and we're celebrating that at our Founders Day celebration this coming Sunday.
How have the services that STAR provides changed over the past 100 years as Michigan has changed? Certainly our economy has changed.
Well, what we're doing is staying very true to our beliefs, our core values about believing in children. We're now taking that from the start of how STAR began, primarily in residential services, and we're broadening that into community-based professional training. We're now reaching out to children with neurological differences. STAR has educational services. So what's happening with STAR now is we're reaching out into the communities and in the places where people live to actually take the work to them, whereas in the last 100 years, a lot of children were coming to us to receive our services here in Albion, Michigan, and other sites. But we're seeing the need to take that right into the communities, and we're having great success with that.
Martin, how have state budget cuts, especially the ones made to social service programs, how has that affected the children you serve?
Of course, across the country, we're finding that state agencies and nonprofit sector agencies like STAR are struggling to transform and figure out how are they going to meet the needs of children, families, and communities at the same time that we're seeing shrinking resources. One of the greatest ways that we receive resources, and really there are three or four ways that we do, through possibly contracting through state of Michigan in this case, or through individuals that want to pay for our services directly. Literally every program that we offer requires some level of subsidization so we can provide the level of care and the quality that children richly deserve.
Is Michigan doing enough for vulnerable children, do you think?
My opinion is that we need to invest in our children earlier, and it really doesn't make sense to wait until problems evolve to some of the serious levels that they do. Children that are suffering from trauma, so children who are dropping out of our school systems, children that have neurological differences and we're not meeting their needs. So my opinion is obviously that we need to invest a lot more in our children earlier to get out ahead of these problems and do a lot more in terms of prevention and early intervention with our children.
Celebrating a century of helping children in need in Michigan, Dr. Martin Mitchell, President and CEO of STAR Commonwealth. You can learn more about their 100th anniversary celebration this Sunday. Just go to their website, STAR, and that's two R's, STARR.org. Martin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Techno music was invented in Michigan. It was created by young black musicians from the Detroit area, actually from Belleville. And it happened in the 1980s. They were experimenting with futuristic sounds and different kinds of beats and wound up inventing a genre that blew up around the world. Electronic music still thrives in Detroit. Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris has this profile of one musician who's been touring the world but still finds inspiration and comfort in his home state of Michigan.
Zach Saginaw's background is as a jazz drummer, and his electronic music doesn't exactly sound like jazz. But you can easily hear how his songs are ruled by rhythm. Saginaw records and performs electronic music under the name Shigeto. He was born and raised in Ann Arbor, and his family is Jewish and Japanese. He played the drums growing up, and he almost flunked out of high school, but music saved him. Saginaw's music has always been the easiest way for him to express stuff that's hard to talk about.
Growing up, I felt very kind of two-sided. I felt like I didn't fit in with the kind of general American just vision of what a good kid would be here. But I also felt very disconnected from my roots, whether it was my Japanese side or my Jewish side.
He says by making music under the name Shigeto, which is actually his middle name, it became easier to explore things like his family's history and to honor his Japanese relatives.
In a nutshell, after Pearl Harbor was bombed, all the people of Japanese descent living on the West Coast were whisked away one day and put into internment camps. They could bring one suitcase per family member, and they didn't know when they were coming back. And so my grandmother, my grandfather, everyone on my mom's side of the family were in these internment camps. And I think it affected us in many ways, consciously and subconsciously, throughout the generations. Like, I don't speak Japanese, for instance. My mother never spoke it to me. My grandmother didn't really speak it to my mother. And I think it's because you go through an experience like that, and you're like, wow, I don't want this to ever come back. I don't want this to happen again. So you kind of suppress that side of you and try to be as American or fit in as much as you can.
He made and dedicated the album Lineage to his grandparents, with a special shout out to his grandmother.
I wanted to basically express to her how much her life and what she's been through has affected me. But it's hard to talk about that stuff, especially to maybe someone with that much of an age difference. And dedicating my music to her and sharing her experience was the best way I could think of kind of being like, hey, I know, I feel you, it affects me, and here, I love you, whatever.
Saginaw is also inspired by places in Michigan. On his newest album, he's got a song that's named after the city he now calls home, Detroit.
My biggest influences are my surroundings, I guess, and I honestly feel, I might be a bit biased, but I feel that there's something in the water here in terms of music. The history is so rich and goes back so far, whether we're talking Motown or jazz or techno or rap or, punk. I got so much love for where I come from, and no matter where I'm living, whether I was in Brooklyn or London, or people would say, where are you from? And I would say Michigan. And I just think it's good to share with people where you come from if you care about it.
One of his songs is named after a place in Ann Arbor called Huron River Drive.
I just like to give people something that they can relate to. You know, when somebody comes up to me and they go, oh, I was listening to Huron River Drive, and I was driving down Huron River Drive, and I was so proud to be from Ann Arbor, and it just fit, and da-da-da-da. It's like, it means everything. It's like, wow, this is actually affecting people the way I would hope to.
Saginaw says he had a particular chord progression in his head for years. And as he worked on the song, he started getting this nostalgic feeling.
And I was just thinking, like, where do I feel this feeling, you know? And I was like, oh, you know, home. And I was just thinking of where I go, where I've been driving, certain places that maybe I've driven on hundreds of times. And it just kind of fit, yeah. And kind of the textures too, the chimes, the cymbals, it's kind of like wind in the trees, the water on one side of you.
And Huron River Drive is sort of famous for being the scenic road that you can drive if you just need to unwind.
It's like if you have a fight with your girlfriend or something, you storm out of the house and then all of a sudden you're on this road and everything's okay again.
Saginaw says he would not be a happy person if he couldn't make music. In 2012, he toured all over the world, and he played almost 180 shows in 360 days. He says during that year, he had a lot of time to do some serious self-reflection, and that inspired a batch of songs that are about being honest with yourself. His new album is called No Better Time Than Now.
That piece was produced for Stateside by Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit emergency manager Kevin Orr sent out the strongest hint yet that prized pieces in the DIA collection are indeed on the table as a way to put money into the city coffers. Without offering many details, Orr told the Detroit Economic Club today that there are ways for the DIA to make money from its artwork that might not involve outright sales, perhaps would involve long-term leases. But Orr was clear, he must consider ways to use the museum's treasures to help the bankrupt city. Also earlier this week, another one of the city's jewels was back in the spotlight. The state and Mayor Dave Bing announced an agreement under which the state DNR would indeed run Belle Isle as Michigan's 102nd state park. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes joins us now. And Daniel, the reaction to that news from the Coleman A. Young Municipal Building has left you more than a little frustrated, hasn't it?
Well, it's predictable. We don't know if we want to do this. Well, we need to look and see if there's another option. You've got some people saying they can't be seizing one of our assets. Well, this is an asset that the city can't afford to maintain and hasn't maintained adequately for a very long time. And the proposal would have the city still owning the island. It's not going anywhere, and it's also not being sold off to private developers or anything else. The state would maintain it and put some money into it. And yet three months into bankruptcy, you get more reminders this week that people in positions of leadership, either at the pension funds or City Hall, they still don't get it, that the city is bankrupt.
So what does that tell you? What does that reaction tell you? I know you're saying, hey, wake up, and you're clueless. But deeper, what do you think is happening?
Well, I think it's a manifestation of the fact that leaders, the so-called leaders here, do not understand the depth of the predicament that the city's in and what it portends for their patch. For example, the pension funds have petitioned the bankruptcy court this week and asked the judge to allow them to get another judge to rule that would allow them to start paying a 13th check again to their pensioners and even active employees. And these are pension funds that are already underfunded. There's an argument about how underfunded they are, but there's no dispute that they are underfunded. And by taking those additional earnings that they're making in a fairly strong equity market and then disbursing them to people above and beyond what they're supposed to disburse them for, all that does is eat away at the asset base of the pension fund that's supposed to support people well into old age.
And wasn't it clear that 13th check over the years is part of what got them in this dilemma in the first place?
Yeah, and I think that's really kind of the point I'm making here about the cluelessness of some of these leaders. I mean, you've also got the situation that we've talked about a lot at the DIA. This past weekend, my colleague Nolan Finley wrote a column citing sources basically saying there is going to be something done with the art, and people need to get on the bus here and at the DIA and be part of some kind of solution here, as opposed to just saying it can't be done, we're not going to be part of it, because something is going to happen. And I think you put all this stuff into the stew, and you want to say to people, do you really realize the seriousness of the situation we're in right now? You can't keep operating as if it's business as usual, because it clearly is not.
Let's look at this city council reaction, and now we also work in the fact that both candidates for mayor say they're against the Belle Isle lease, so that's something Mike Duggan and Benny Napoleon apparently agree on. They're both talking about alternative plans, although we haven't heard any details or names of players. Is this a matter of sheer incompetence, or is this kind of that truculence of you're not going to Lansing, you're not going to tell us what to do?
I think it's a combination of the two, and I would add a third, and the third is politicking. Remember, we are 5 weeks or so away from an election in the city of Detroit that will elect a new city council, seven of the nine members of whom will be drawn from districts for the first time since 1918, and a new mayor. So I think you have these politicians, particularly the ones who are going to be standing for re-election, to stake out what they believe is the most politically advantageous position. And I don't think there's any question, but that's what's going on here. Mike Duggan, I think, clearly is trying to put together a policy that he can sell. I heard him on another radio interview say this morning that he would have preferred that this happened after the election, the thinking being that this was something he was going to go to the governor with anyway and say, look, this is the way I think we can do this. And his argument is Detroit has to prove that it can govern itself. Fair point. But the reaction to the Belle Isle thing so far and some of the things we're seeing coming from the pension funds is that they probably can't.
And so what do you think all of this says, this kind of attitude you call the Detroit slow walk, that chronic foot dragging? What does this say to the rest of Michigan, and what does it say to Lansing?
Well, I think to Lansing, I would take it in a couple of pieces. I think to the governor's office, I think it's confirmatory that they did the right thing in terms of appointing the emergency manager and taking the city into bankruptcy. They came to that conclusion after they saw how difficult it was to get anything accomplished under the consent agreement, that the elected officials really couldn't move forward. And Kevin Orr's had to do that. And I think it's probably the same thing for the state. I mean, the governor's going to be running for re-election, and I suspect that the bankruptcy filing and the appointment of emergency manager in Detroit is not hurt him politically outside of the city of Detroit, that on balance there's probably a lot of people that think this is something that should have happened a long time ago.
And what do you think this kind of behavior will do to the mindset of the rest of Michigan when we keep hearing it said, you know, as Detroit is a part of Michigan, mm-hmm. trying to work against that sense of let it happen there, we don't care, we're living up in Northwest Michigan?
I think more people my instinct is people are more hopeful that Detroit can make the turn now than they've been in a long time, because I see a lot of things going right in the city. You have a very active business and foundation community. You've got Kevin Orr restructuring. You've got services that are either being privatized or exited altogether, which takes pressure off the tax base.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the federal government that is using a lot of existing federal programs to support restructuring in the city and ease some of the pain of that restructuring. So there's a lot of things going right than there is going wrong. And on top of that, you've got this election. So some of the people that are raising objections today in the first week of October may not be part of the situation come January 1st.
But when you think that both, as you say, they're doing politics, but both Mike Duggan and Benny Napoleon mm-hmm. are against this state plan with Belle Isle, does that cause concern for you?
No, not necessarily. I think it's predictable. I think I'd be stunned if either one of them said, oh, yeah, let that happen. I think the devil is in the details in the sense of what they would propose. And I suspect, given his background, Mike Duggan is going to put forth a proposal that is city-driven but essentially gets to the same place that the governor wants to get to, which is to improve Belle Isle.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our weekly check-in. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This past summer certainly brought us some challenging days in terms of heavy rain, thunderstorms, sewers unable to handle the fast and furious downpours. And all of that is giving scientists cause for concern, including my next guest. Dr. Larissa Larson is an associate professor in the Urban and Regional Planning Program at the University of Michigan, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
I have to say, having just in the last couple of weeks been caught in two monster downpours where you think it's going to end, it doesn't. We were in Ferndale and we were watching Nine Mile Road. It was a gully washer. And as we drove along on Woodward, sewers had backed up, cars were stalling in the middle of Woodward. And it does seem that it is heavier than we remember. And so that's not just a perception.
No, even though climate scientists are always careful to warn us that we can't attribute any particular happening, we have seen that rain intensities in this area have been increasing. And the statistics vary. We think in the last 5 years, federal scientists have said that heavy rains are up 45%. So there really is something there.
And you co-authored a report on climate change vulnerability in Detroit for the Detroit Climate Action Collaborative. And I saw that you called this something like a slow Hurricane Katrina. How so?
Oh, yes. I don't like to unnecessarily alarm people.
Sure.
But I think we need to all be concerned, particularly with vulnerable populations, as we have more extreme events. We're fortunate in Michigan in that what we see with climate change involves warmer temperatures in winter and more intense rain events. We're not going to have probably the droughts, the wildfires, some of the other extremes that are going to happen elsewhere in the United States.
We're seeing it now, yes.
Exactly. But I think what we need to be aware of is even in cities such as Detroit, Grand Rapids, other places, we have vulnerable populations. And in 1995, when there was an extreme heat event in Chicago, we saw over 700 people die.
We had that happen in Michigan. I remember it very, very well.
Yes. And so as one of the things that climate scientists are telling us is that we're going to have more frequent, intense, long-lasting heat extremes. And so that's one thing that we have to be really paying attention to, is thinking, can we respond to people in a timely way? Do we know where vulnerable populations are? And there's the emergency response, and then there's long-term responses about how do we shape our cities in ways that help reduce the likelihood of hotspots, of urban heat islands occurring in cities.
And as we talk about heat, how does that also fit in then with the heavy rain situation when we see this 45% increase in heavy rain?
Right. Well, these are complex and linked systems that I won't pretend to describe in detail. I rely on my colleagues for that. But really, when we see elevated temperatures, there's more energy in the systems, mm-hmm. and that means often there are more rain events that result in this.
They're more ferocious.
So, yes. So there are forcing mechanisms that are very linked between these.
But they are linked, and you're working with other scholars and the Graham Institute for Sustainability to study just how the changing climate is impacting cities in the Great Lakes. So as we say that, beyond the wow, we saw cars, you know, stranded on main streets because the sewers couldn't handle it. What kinds of changes are you finding?
Well, in thinking with cities, what they can do, one thing is infrastructure. So cities have traditionally planned their futures much based on past experiences, happenings. So this, what were the temperatures expected to be? And now we need, with the changing climate situation, to alter some of those. So, for example, in a water system, there will be considerations of these curves. They're called intensity, duration, and frequency curves, and they help you consider how much your system will need to contain, hold, and when you have an extreme rain event. We're seeing that these are increasing and they're changing. They're shifting the patterns, particularly in the complex Great Lakes region where we have many microclimates in that. So cities shouldn't do what they've always done. They now have to consider new information on climate as they plan ahead. So the IDF curves are important things for stormwater management. We see also, too, when we think about green buildings and sustainable buildings, the way we model energy in buildings is based on what's called the typical meteorological year. Mm-hmm. That's from 1970. It's actually different now. And so as we, again, much of urban planning is trying to think into the future, which is challenging with uncertainty, but we need to realize we need to incorporate new information to make better decisions.
And here we're talking about cities needing to think in new ways, but dealing with creaky old infrastructure like our sewer systems.
Absolutely. We see it in Detroit and many, many cities, mm-hmm. all over the country. But particularly we're challenged in cities like Detroit, Toledo, and Cleveland, Chicago, that have combined sewer systems. So that means one pipe is used for the sewage and for the stormwater. So that usually works just fine on a regular day. Mm-hmm. But we saw in 2011, where we had a lot of intense rainfalls, the systems become overwhelmed, and you can't flood the wastewater treatment plant. So what you have to do is directly release this partially treated or untreated effluent and mixture of stormwater right into the receiving waters, which in the case of Detroit is into the Detroit River and into the Great Lakes system.
In fact, I saw one statistic, was I right, 32 billion gallons of untreated or partially treated sewage poured into the Detroit and Rouge Rivers.
It's amazing. It's a huge wastewater treatment plant there in Detroit that can treat 930 million gallons a day, but some of these rain events, twice as much water is flowing into them. And so how do we, again, think about changing that system and even upgrade? So can we separate the systems, which they're trying to do in places like Toledo, create separate stormwater and sewage systems? But then also we have to consider this new information about how we're going to, in winter and spring particularly, have increased precipitation.
And yet it's no secret of Detroit's money problems, and the ability to even keep streetlights on is a challenge, let alone what would be incredibly costly changes to the storm drain system, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And so this is one of the interesting things from a planning perspective, is that cities are dealing with trying to maintain or improve services today, often with limited finances, and they're also trying to look ahead and say, you're telling me that I have to upsize this system when it's not even working that well today. Uh-huh. And so it's really a moving target that you're trying to hit to think about. I like to think about it as, how do we understand systematic uncertainty? So how do we make certain signposts or targets that we say, okay, we're pretty confident these things are going to happen, but within those have robust approaches to manage when, again, the variability is a lot of what we're talking about here. And cities trying to manage more variability is an extreme challenge.
You are investigating ways that, urban planning can enhance resilience. So I'm wondering, have there been action initiatives that you've discovered that really have made a difference in the way our cities respond to climate change? Are people doing things that are worth learning from?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are cities around the world that are acting. It's interesting. Global climate change has to be addressed for mitigation at the global scale. But locally, our cities are often tasked with responding and adapting to these changes. So they're kind of where the situations have to be realized about what are we going to do. But there's some really fascinating work coming out from many cities. The city of Toronto is doing some very good work about identifying vulnerability and really prioritizing if they have a power outage during an extreme heat event when air conditioning would stop. Mm-hmm. How, you know, what are the parts of the city we need to worry about? Where are vulnerable people? In the city of Toronto, they have many high rises, and they know that within 2 hours, if the power goes out in a building with inoperable windows, it's no longer habitable. We put many of our seniors in high-rise buildings. And so how do we make sure that we have plans ready to go, again, for the short term, and then in the long term, we think of strategies that aren't just dependent on air conditioning and would be less vulnerable to these changes?
How confident are you that the people who are running cities in Michigan are going to be able to think that far ahead and affect these changes, find the money to do these changes?
Again, I'm really impressed that many cities are trying to take actions. So finding money for some of these things is key. And one of the creative strategies that's happening in Ann Arbor and in other places across the country is using a stormwater utility approach where you levy a fee, not a tax, but a fee for how much stormwater you contribute. So it's a way to capture an environmental externality, make people realize they're contributing to the system and give them incentives to do on-site stormwater management. What I'm always amazed is we've got to get more and more creative all the time about how to tie people to these systems and make them recognize that we're all contributing and we all have to kind of take it on at, almost at a personal level to lessen some of our demands.
It certainly seems like your students have their work cut out with them as they shape the cities of the future.
Yes, we think so. And hopefully the fun part is they're so enthusiastic and hopeful that it keeps me hopeful too.
Dr. Larissa Larson is an associate professor in the Urban and Regional Planning Program at the University of Michigan, and she was kind enough to join us in the studio. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.